The Americans were not in Italy to sightsee, or romance, or drink, or otherwise have fun. They were there to engage the Germans in combat, not on the ground or at sea, but in the air. That gave them some privileges, such as cots to sleep on, hot, if not very good, food prepared by cooks, time off, faster promotions, and more. They were grateful that they were not in the infantry, sleeping in foxholes and being shot at, or in the Navy, cooped up on a ship for interminable voyages, going wherever the captain directed, almost never seeing the enemy except in the air, yet still taking great risks that, when a ship got destroyed, led to the death by wounds or drowning of almost every one of their mates. Except for a tiny number of volunteers, no one wanted to be in a submarine. But it was the case in World War II that the U.S. servicemen in the Navy were glad they were where they were, instead of in a foxhole or a bomber, while those in the infantry wanted no part of flying. They liked keeping their feet on the ground. Virtually every sailor or soldier shuddered at the thought of being in an airplane when it got hit by enemy fighters or flak. McGovern met two infantry officers after the war and said to them, "Whenever I'd fly over you guys, I thought it must be terrible to be down there in the mud, hand-to-hand fighting, all that shelling." And the infantrymen told him, "Seeing you guys overhead and the Germans shooting away at you, we thought you didn't have a chance if you take a direct hit." To McGovern's surprise, they were feeling sorry for us. For himself, McGovern said, "I always knew that it would take infantry to win the war, but I also thought that the bombers and the fighter planes were essential too, that without those planes, the infantry could not prevail against the Germans." For the men of the AAF flying the planes, death was a constant threat. Lieutenant Capps of the 456th Bomb Group arrived in Cerignola in January 1944. That month, he celebrated his 21st birthday. There were three other young officers with him, Lieutenants Douglas S. Morgan, Gail J. Scritchfield, and Edward J. Hefner. Morgan and Scritchfield were fellow pilots. Hefner was a bombardier. They shared a camaraderie. "We were all very young, eager, patriotic, and anxious to begin the great adventure of flying combat missions." At first, they were fed by the 301st Bomb Group mess kitchens. Capps never forgot the faces of the 301st crew members when they arrived in the mess tent where he was eating after returning from a mission into Germany. They all looked stunned, strained, emotionally drained, and very fatigued. They talked amongst themselves about how their buddies had been shot down on the mission, the number of parachutes they had seen coming from the falling planes, and planes that had blown up without any chance of men bailing out. The looks and talk of the returned crew brought a sense of reality to Capps, but still, "I didn't believe that I was going to be one that was shot down, and I couldn't wait to get into combat." Within 4 months of his arrival at Cerignola, all three of Capps' friends, Morgan, Scritchfield, and Hefner, were gone. Each had a violent death in crashes in their B-24s. Later, a tent mate of Capps, Lieutenant Nicholas Colletti, a bombardier, was shot down and killed. When Capps completed his missions, 51 of them, on July 7, 1944, his co-pilot, Lieutenant Sidney Brooks, became the B-24's pilot. 2 weeks after he took command of the plane, Brooks had a wing knocked off by enemy fire, and his plane collided with another B-24 in the formation. Brooks spun violently to the ground and was killed. The other plane exploded. As with the other squadrons, the 741st was taking heavy casualties and losses. Commander Lanford was one of them. He had been awarded a Distinguished Flying Cross for leading a mission over Vienna on March 17, 1944, but on July 21, his plane was shot down on a mission against Brooks, Czechoslovakia. The flak bursts severed the control cables. Lanford attempted a hard right turn, but the control wheel spun like a roulette wheel. The plane was losing altitude fast. He ordered everyone to bail out. Lanford landed safely, got in contact with Tito's partisans, and managed to return to base, where he went into the mess hall to be greeted by the operations officer, who exclaimed, "My God, I thought you were dead." Lanford went back to flying in combat and completed his tour. but the squadron historical diary noted the destruction of his and other B-24s, and it declared, "Replacements are sorely needed, as our status at the moment could aptly be called quasi-operational." Beyond the many B-24s shot down, there was sudden death from accidents. Shortly after arriving in Italy, Sergeant Kenneth Higgins, McGovern's radio operator, saw one. Right after taking off, the pilot was supposed to hit the brake pedals to keep the landing gear's wheels from spinning as they retracted. But on this occasion, the Liberator was not yet airborne when the pilot hit the brakes, and the plane nosed over and plowed into the ground. All the men in the front of the aircraft were killed. Pilot Lieutenant Guyon Phillips saw a similar accident. Just before liftoff, the pilot hit the brakes. A B-24 with a full load of gas and bombs just won't get in the air without full power, Phillips commented. This time, the plane was at the end of the runway. The nose gear sheared off, and the nose of the plane ground into the earth with such force that it chewed off the front of the plane right up to the engines. All the men in the front were instantly killed. Another time, a B-24 came in to land. It had a bomb hung up in the bomb bay, but the pilot, who should have checked to make sure all the bombs had dropped, had not. The bomb fell out when he landed, went off, and blew the whole plane into pieces. The whole crew burned, Higgins recalled. I mean, they were just charred ashes. Once a bomber gained altitude, the crew had some chance of survival when things went wrong. Some managed to get out of a doomed Liberator, pull the ripcord on their parachute, and land safely. Some of them managed to bail out over neutral Switzerland or Yugoslavia, where, if they were lucky enough to join with Tito's partisans, they could return to Italy. But many, perhaps most, became prisoners of war. Until the Battle of the Bulge in December 1944, the Germans held far more AAF men as prisoners than they did American infantry. The AAF knew that the capture of men who had bailed out was always a possibility. To prevent this, it gave each member of a crew an escape kit consisting of some candy bars, a shot of morphine, a silk map of Europe, and a compass. That wasn't much. The men were also instructed that the only information they had to give their captors was their name, rank, and serial number. Generally, they gave out more than that, not necessarily willingly, but sometimes to avoid torture, more often in what they regarded as casual conversation. The German interrogators were young men, good in English, usually former flyers themselves, now without an arm or otherwise injured, and they would get the POWs to chatting, almost like shop talk. Like most people their age, the prisoners were willing to brag about such matters as, how fast does your plane go, or can you do a roll in it, and so on. Further, the Germans already had excellent information, such as the base of the squadron or the name of its commander. A vast majority of POWs insisted after the war that they had never told the Germans anything of value. The Germans, however, said they got everything they wanted from the prisoners. The men on both sides were stretching the truth pretty considerably. Once a man was captured, he was out of the control of the AAF, but he was still in the military and subject to military discipline. The POWs hated the experience, but most of them managed to live through it without compromise. Pilot Lieutenant Walter Shostak of the 741st Squadron was one of them. He was on his fourth mission, over a refinery in Austria, when the plane he was flying took a direct hit from a flak shell that exploded on the B-24's nose, killing the bombardier and nose gunner instantly. The plane began to lose altitude so badly that it was about to crash into a mountain. Shostak ordered the crew to bail out. They were now over Yugoslavia, and all of them, including Shostak, parachuted down safely. But three of them were shot on the ground by SS troops who claimed they were terrorists. They didn't give them a chance. Alone, Shostak managed to hide for a week. He hooked up with some of Tito's partisans, and they were helping him to escape, but, unfortunately, they stopped at a farmhouse, and a boy ran to tell partisans fighting for the Germans. They found Shostak in the attic. When they discovered that he was an American, they gave him an apple. Shostak had grown up speaking Russian, which is similar to Serbian. The Serbians said they were not fighting the Americans, they were fighting the communists. That was a bit ironic to Shostak, whose family had left Russia to get away from the communists. As he noted, you really couldn't tell who was who in that war without a program. Eventually, Shostak was taken to Frankfurt, where he underwent interrogation. The German asking the questions was, of all things, a former used car salesman from Detroit. It was mid-1944, and, as Shostak put it, he knew by then that the war was lost, so he gave me some tea and cookies. The German really was hoping to loosen Shostak's tongue, but unfortunately for him, having been shot down on our fourth mission, I didn't know anything. Shostak was sent to Stalag Luft 3. It was a large camp. Prisoners in it before Shostak arrived had dug a tunnel, and some 60 of them managed to wiggle through it and escape. But, unfortunately for them, the Germans rounded up most of them, brought them back, and shot them in front of the other POWs. So they stopped digging tunnels, and for Shostak there was nothing to do except play cards, wonder when the next meal was coming, and wait for the end of the war. Because of the German respect for rank, Lieutenant Shostak and the other officers had a little easier time of it as compared to the enlisted men. Officers were not made to work. The prison barracks were divided into 12 tiers. Each tier had 12 beds, 4 beds, 3 layers high. There were 144 men in Shostak's barracks, one stove at one end and one faucet with cold water at the other. That faucet was the sanitary facility. There was a latrine outside, but the POWs had to get permission from a guard to use it. Rations were miserable. The bread was made apparently from sawdust, and there was only one piece of it per man. The guards would set the ration down outside the door. The Germans did hand out coffee, but as far as Shostak could tell, it was made from ground-up acorns. Once a week, if he was lucky, he got a piece of horse meat. Occasionally, the American POWs received Red Cross parcels with food, but there was a contingent of Russian prisoners next to Stalag Luft 3, and if the Americans thought they had it bad, all they had to do was look at the Russians to know what true misery was. So they would divide their Red Cross parcels and throw half of the food over the fence to the Russians. The Red Cross also sent cigarettes, which did a world of good when it came to trading for food. The Germans would barter anything they had for American cigarettes. The POWs had a radio hidden in a tin can, which allowed them to keep aware of what was going on. The main thing they wanted to know was, how close are the Allies to our camp? On April 29, 1945, just as they were being liberated, they got the American Armed Forces Network on the radio. The first thing they heard was a popular song, "Don't Fence Me In." Given where he had been for almost a year, Shostak thought the words were kind of comical. Shostak's final judgment was, war is a terrible thing, and anybody that tells you otherwise was probably a supply sergeant somewhere in the middle of Kansas who had no idea what combat is about. As far as he was concerned, it was just something we had to go do. In the end, I loved my crew, and that's about all I loved. War is not a joyful experience. Decades later, he enjoyed watching war movies. His wife asked him how come he did, as he hated war so much. I explained that while watching a war movie, there is no danger of getting shot, and you can concentrate on the storyline and not worry about a piece of flak coming through the windshield. In the 741st Squadron, there were 12 B-24s and 23 crews. That meant 46 pilots and co-pilots, plus more than 50 other officers. When McGovern arrived, many had been in combat, while others, like himself, were waiting to go. Whatever their status, every one of them knew the dangers of getting shot down or being forced to bail out, or how likely it was that they would have a fatal accident. Death, or the possibility of captivity, was all around these young men. Whether in the officers' club or the airmen's club for enlisted men, the newcomers would sit quietly and listen to the talk of the veterans who had just returned from a mission. McGovern listened hard and thereby picked up tips on flying a B-24 in combat. The talk was about what had happened, how the plane performed, what the German flak was like, and other details. Always they discussed how many parachutes they had counted coming from a plane going down, but not about who had made it out of the doomed craft and who had not. They assumed that a parachute meant the man had landed safely, but they had no idea whether he had escaped and was on his way back to Italy, or had been made a POW, or had been killed on the ground. Shostak's name never came up. Sergeant Mel Ten Hagen, a radio operator in the 455th Bomb Group, remembered the talk as both enlightening and frightening. It was unlike the talk one usually heard from young men after an examination or a football or basketball game. There was no pride of individual accomplishment here or boasting about comparative achievements. Further, there was no jesting about those, like Ten Hagen, McGovern, and the other recent arrivals, who hadn't been up yet because everyone knew that would happen tomorrow or a day after. Ten Hagen also noted that there was no overt elation by those who had completed 34 missions because everyone remembered the one who got his on his 35th. No one talked to impress. Experiences were shared only because better understanding of techniques and tactics would improve the odds for survival. Sergeant Ten Hagen had arrived at Chirignola with two other crews. One of those crews was the first to go out on a mission. It was a long one. Their plane returned safely, but with holes caused by flak in its wings and fuselage. That evening, after they had finished their post-mission interrogation, they were withdrawn and did not want to talk. They felt it might be better if we discussed feelings later, maybe after we had all completed some combat missions. As for Ten Hagen and his crew, we wondered if they'd ever again have the optimistic, cheerful, normal personalities we had known. A day later, the second crew flew its initial mission. The plane was 2 hours late getting back to base. Suddenly, in the darkness along the row of tents, one of the gunners appeared, panting, with some of his parachute gathered over his arm and the rest of it dragging behind. He was frightened. He demanded to know where the rest of his crew was. Told that no one knew, he explained that his B-24 had been hit over the target. He could not assess the effect of the damage, but related that his pilot had gotten the plane to the airfield, where he circled to test the controls and to burn the remaining fuel. Crash landing a B-24 was always hazardous, but especially so when there was fuel in the wings. The pilot was unsure of whether or not the landing gear would operate, as his hydraulic power had gone. He told the crew to bail out. He would stay with the plane and try to bring it down. A messenger came running in from the flight line. He said the pilot had made it safely, but the plane had broken up on landing. Had the crew still been on board, many of the men would have been injured or killed. Over the next 2 hours, the rest of the crew straggled in, dragging their parachutes. There was no celebration and precious little discussion, but the men sure were grateful for the pilot's action. The AAF had a rule that enlisted men and officers were not allowed to fraternize, which was why the officers had their own club at Chirignola, the enlisted men another. But their tents were next to each other. They ate together. Most of the time they went into each other's clubs. The clubs had beer, usually warm, and soft drinks. The vast majority of the men did not indulge in even the beer on the night they were listed for a mission in the morning. Most officers and the sergeants considered the non-fraternization rule absurd. "Our crew was one family," Lieutenant Shostak said, "and we fraternized all the time." The crew went wherever the pilot took them, and he went wherever the bomb group commander told him to go. It was the same with an infantry platoon or a naval crew on a destroyer or other ship of war. They had the need for togetherness to bind them. On the ground, as in the air, they shared. Whatever the pilot's age or number of missions, they all looked up to him, trusted him, would do whatever he told them to do, as with the pilot who had his crew bail out over Chirignola, then landed the plane himself. That was, after all, his first mission. On the 50th anniversary of VE Day, I was with former Sergeant Joe Heller, a bombardier with the 12th Air Force and the author of Catch-22. Heller told me, "I never had a bad officer." Astonished, I said, "Joe, you created Major, 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 Colonel Cathcart, General Dreidel, Lieutenant Minderbinder, and so many others. Everybody in the world knows about them. How can you tell me you never had a bad officer?" "They are all invention," he replied. "Every single officer, from when I went into the service to going over to Italy, to flying the missions, to when I got discharged, every one of them was good. In the course of interviewing George McGovern for this book, I told him what Heller had told me. McGovern agreed. "That's my experience," he said. "I was impressed by the pilots, the bombardiers, the navigators, right across the board, and with the operations officers and our group commander. I thought they were a superior bunch of men, and I can honestly say I don't recall a bad officer. All through combat, I had confidence that our officers were doing the very best they knew how. If they made mistakes, they weren't foolish mistakes. Our officers were superb." Obviously, there were some weak, some poor, some inefficient or ignorant, and some absolutely terrible officers in the U.S. Armed Services in World War II. But if such men ever got into combat positions, the AAF, the Army, the Navy, or the Marines got them out at once. Men's lives depended on them, after all. The combat officers knew it and acted accordingly. Ask the Germans who opposed them how good they were, or the Japanese. The American officers were superb, and that is the way it was in the 741st Squadron, 455th Bomb Group, in Cerignola, Italy. Chapter 6. Learning to Fly in Combat. The AAF policy in the fall of 1944 was to have the pilots fly their first 5 combat missions as co-pilots with a veteran and an experienced crew. McGovern was, in his words, lucky, because his pilot was Captain Howard Serbeck of Washington State. He was older, 24 years old to McGovern's 22, and he had circles under his eyes, and he was obviously feeling the strain of combat. He had flown 25 missions when McGovern flew with him. It was his tent that Lieutenant Rounds, with McGovern on board, had torn in half with his jeep, but Serbeck never mentioned it to McGovern. Serbeck let McGovern do quite a bit of the flying from his co-pilot seat, sometimes half the mission. The experience taught McGovern more about what it's like to have all that gear on, and to go to 25,000 feet in sub-zero temperatures, and stay in formation, and get shot at, and all the other things that go with combat missions. Serbeck brought me along. McGovern's first mission was November 11, 1944, Armistice Day. The night before, he checked and saw his name on the assignment sheet. The morning began for him when the operations sergeant came into his tent at 4 a.m. to wake him. On his first 5 missions, Rounds and Adams could stay in the sack, as they were not going. McGovern went to the mess hall for a powdered egg breakfast. Then he climbed into a truck for the drive to the group's operations room for the briefing. At the door, an MP examined his identification and checked his name on the assignment sheet, then opened the door so McGovern and those from his truck could enter. Inside, the 300 or so crew sat on planks placed over cinder blocks. When a staff officer announced that they were all present and accounted for, the door was locked. The group commander, by the fall of 1944, was Colonel William Snowden. He was in his mid-40s, a grandfather figure to the pilots and crews. He had gray hair, but a commanding presence. McGovern said he had the total confidence of everyone in our group, a good man and a good leader. Just the way he moved around, he was reassuring without being condescending. When Colonel Snowden strode in, everyone stood at attention. Snowden climbed onto the platform, put the men at ease, and after saying good morning, motioned to a member of his staff to pull a drawstring. Behind the curtain was a large map of southern and central Europe. The pilots and crew members saw their route and the target drawn on the map with erasable marks. When it was Vienna or Munich or any other target known to be well defended by anti-aircraft guns, or if it was 4 or more hours flying time from Cerignola, a dismal groan slowly became audible. But on this occasion, there were murmurs of approval, because the target was Linz, Austria, not so terribly far away, without any known anti-aircraft batteries to fly over, and not so well protected itself. It could be what the men called a milk run. Later in the war, Linz would become one of the most heavily defended targets in Europe. Colonel Snowden got the men to quiet down and gave way to the weather officer, who described what the cloud cover and winds were likely to be over Linz. Then he went over conditions on the route and what to expect on the way home and what it would be like over Chirignola when they got back. Next, the operations officer described the nature of the marshalling yards they were going after and explained that the mission was important because the Germans were moving men and materiel through Linz on their way to the Italian front. He warned the pilots and bombardiers to make every possible effort to avoid hitting the cultural sites and educational buildings. By this stage of the war, the bombardiers in the squadron would toggle their switches when they saw the lead plane, with the best navigator and bombardier, drop its bombs. Next, the men were told who would be the pilot of the lead plane. He was always a good pilot. Sometimes he was a major, but often Colonel Snowden would lead the missions. When that happened, the men would again murmur their approval. The briefing would conclude with the group chaplain leading them in a prayer. Dismissal came from Snowden, but only after he had the men hack their watches. They would pull the stems of their watches when the second hand reached 12. Snowden would have them set the minute and hour hands to correspond to his, then count to 10 and call hack, and they would push the stems back in. They filed out of the briefing room to go to another briefing, one for the pilots and co-pilots, another for radio operators, another for navigators and bombardiers, still another for gunners. The men climbed into trucks for the ride to the storage sheds just off the runway where their flying equipment and parachutes were located. Each crew got out and dressed for the mission. They were going up to 20,000 feet or even higher, and it was going to be cold up there, between 20 and 50 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. McGovern and the others pulled on heavy winter underwear. Next, they put on long wool socks and a wool military uniform, slacks and shirts, olive drab. Then, a leather jacket and leather trousers, both lined with sheepskin. Then, sheepskin-lined heavy boots. Big, heavy, silk-lined leather gloves followed. The sheepskin-lined helmet came down over the ears. Serbeck and McGovern wore Colt 45 automatics in a shoulder holster, then put on backpacks containing their parachutes. The other crew members picked up their parachutes in chest packs, which they carried into the plane by hand. They could snap them on if needed. The parachute packers made their standard joke when giving them out. "If it doesn't work, bring it back and I'll give you another." Dressed, they walked to their plane on its hard stand. Serbeck, accompanied by the chief of the ground crew, walked around the B-24, checking it out visually. The navigator, bombardier, radio man, and gunners would check out their equipment. Later, when the plane had gotten up to 10,000 feet, the pilots and crew put on their oxygen masks. It covered the nose. They plugged cords from their electrically heated flight suits into an outlet on the plane. The four engines created the power for the electricity. They could adjust the heat, turning it down a little or up a bit as needed. Below 15,000 feet, the crew took off their oxygen masks. Serbeck and McGovern kept theirs on until they were down to 10,000 feet. At that altitude, all the smokers lit their cigarettes. The smoke was so thick, it looked like there was a fire. The bombs had been loaded during the night into the bomb bay by the ground crew led by an ordnance officer. They assembled the bombs by taking the stabilizing fins, stored in a separate box, and screwing them on the bombs. Using winches and tractors, the ground crews had hoisted the unwieldy, blunt-nosed 500-pound bombs into their racks. They were inserted into the B-24's womb in a horizontal position and attached to the metal racks. They had a cardboard tag between the bomb and the nose fuse, and at the back end, a wire arming pin. The tail gunner would crawl out on the catwalk over the bomb bay door to pull the tag and then the pin. Climbing into the B-24 with those big, heavy boots and the layers of clothing was always cumbersome as the men waddled ponderously. They carried flak jackets, mandatory since Ploiești. The crew members had difficulty getting themselves into and then adjusted in their cramped positions, especially the nose turret and the tail gunner. The belly turret gunner waited until they were in the air before squeezing with the help of the waist gunner into his bubble. Serbeck and McGovern settled into their seats, with their parachutes serving as a sort of backrest. The seats were encased in cast iron. The iron came up to the knees, then under the seat, and up the back. It was there in the event that flak hit the plane on the bottom side, so that, in McGovern's words, the pilot and co-pilot would have some chance of survival because somebody has to fly the airplane. It wasn't that they were worth more than anybody else on the crew, but if both got killed or badly injured, that plane is going to go down. The moment Sirbeck got into the plane, went to his seat, and put on his earphones and mic attached to his helmet, he was, in McGovern's words, totally in command of the officers and sergeants. McGovern already knew that, but watching Captain Sirbeck go through his routine reinforced the point. McGovern explained, "It had to be that way, because the pilot was the only one with his hands on the controls that determined where the plane was going to go and how it was going to be flown. Of course, he had help, especially from the navigator and the bombardier, the radio operator and the flight engineers. But the request for their help came from Sirbeck. It was his job to check on the crew frequently. He needed to make sure that nobody's oxygen hose had come unhooked. If a tail gunner or someone else failed to answer when the pilot called to him on the intercom, he might well have passed out from a lack of oxygen or frozen because his electric plug had come out without ever noticing that his hose or wire was unhooked. These and other things Sirbeck did as a matter of routine, McGovern noted. To get the engines started, Sirbeck would signal to the flight engineer, who would start the single-cylinder gasoline-powered unit on the B-24. It was called the Putt-Putt and gave a boost to the batteries. Engine number 3, the one nearest McGovern, started first. It powered the generators, which helped start the other engines. When all were operating, Sirbeck did a run-up, checking on each engine's performance, magnetos, temperature, and pressure checks of fuel, oil, and hydraulic systems. When a flare went up, planes began to move out of their hard stands, over the taxiway, and onto the runway, looking like elephants getting ready for a circus parade. Sirbeck called out the final checklist to McGovern. Booster pumps. On. Mixture. Auto rich. Props. Full high. Superchargers. Set. Half flaps. Set. And so on. Sirbeck lined his plane up on the taxi strip, behind some planes and ahead of others. There were 28 in the group, 7 in each squadron. The 454th bomb group was on the other side of the runway, parallel to the 455th, so that the planes from each group could take off side by side. Setting the brakes, Sirbeck pushed the throttle to get the engines running at maximum. When his turn to take off arrived, the roar was almost deafening. The plane vibrated as every nut and bolt, every rivet and tube rattled and shook. 20, or at most 30 seconds after the plane ahead of him began to roll down the runway, Sirbeck released the brakes. A modern air traffic controller or a pilot of a commercial airliner would be appalled at the sight, but for the bomber pilots of World War II, that was how close to each other they were. Down the strip, Sirbeck started rolling, picking up speed until he reached 160 miles per hour. He had his flaps set at 20 degrees, brought the engines to maximum power, and at the end of the runway, he pulled the nose off the ground and became airborne. With the bomb load, the full tanks of fuel, the weight of the crew and their equipment, including the 50-caliber machine guns and ammunition for them, Sirbeck had to fight to gain altitude. It seemed to McGovern that he would not get the plane above treetop altitude, but he did. Barely, but he did. Once the plane was in the air, even if only just, McGovern, as co-pilot, had the task of raising the landing gear and bringing up the flaps. Sirbeck circled, as did all the other pilots, their planes looking rather like hawks over a marsh, and he climbed. The gunners tested their guns. They were Browning M2 50-caliber machine guns. Each gun had about 150 working parts, and the men had been required to strip and reassemble it blindfolded wearing gloves. The guns weighed 64 pounds and fired 800 rounds of ammunition per minute to a range of 600 yards. Sergeant Louis Hansen, a tail gunner in the 743rd Squadron, once discovered that both his guns were jammed. The cocking levers had been put in backward after the guns had been cleaned after the previous mission. He described what he did. There was only space in the turret to get one hand through to a gun. I did one with my right hand, the other with my left. Sweat started to trickle down my back. My goggles steamed over, which made no difference, as there was no way to see what I was doing. The intense cold made me afraid to remove my gloves. But I got the job done, and, as most combat crew members know, one can sweat at 50 degrees below. Fortunately for Serbeck and McGovern, the guns on their Liberator tested okay. After an hour or so, Serbeck's plane had become a part of the formation. It was a squadron box of 7 aircraft. There were 2 3-plane echelons. The lead plane had a wingman just behind and on either side. Serbeck was one of those on the wing of the leader. The second echelon was 40 feet below and 40 feet back of the lead echelon. The 7th aircraft, known as Tail End Charlie, was behind the 2nd echelon. Flying the wing, even for Serbeck, was more difficult than being in the lead, but easier than flying Tail End Charlie. As the last plane in the squadron, Tail End Charlie was the most vulnerable if German fighters attacked, and it was the hardest position to hold. Usually, new pilots and crews got that assignment. On the wing, Serbeck wanted to stay close to the plane he was flying on so as to make as small and infrequent power changes as possible to save the engines and save fuel. Pilot Lieutenant John Smith said that, in due course, flying formation became a reflex like driving a car. The group consisted of 4 squadrons, the lead box, the high box, the low box, and the middle box. More climbing, to 20,000 and eventually 25,000 feet over the Adriatic. Then, off for the target. When the group got to the initial point, it turned, but clouds had moved in over Linz, and the lead pilot decided to abort. He turned, so did the others, and returned to base still fully loaded with the bombs. McGovern's first mission went better than that of Lieutenant David Gandon, a navigator in a B-24. In his war diary, Gandon reported that when his Liberator, called the Snafu, was over the target, a piece of flak came through the cockpit window. The pilot, Lieutenant Bill Marsh, lost the top of his head. The co-pilot, Lieutenant Hillary Bevins, was on his first mission. He called to his radio man, who came to the cockpit wearing a walk-around oxygen bottle, and removed Marsh from the pilot seat. Bevins couldn't stand it with Marsh in the seat and all the blood flowing around. Bevins moved over to the pilot's seat and kept in the formation until it headed off. All the compasses were out, so Bevins flew the opposite direction at the setting sun. All the men were freezing because of the hole in the top of the cockpit. The engineer was sick to his stomach from all the blood. Bevins's eyeball was scratched and Marsh's blood was frozen on his hands. When darkness descended, Bevins flew opposite the North Star. Finally, Snafu got back to base, but Bevins had never made a night landing before. As he came in, he banked too far to the left and knocked off the left landing gear, bounced over, and did the same to the right one. The ship crash-landed and caught on fire. Thank God all got out okay, though Bevins wouldn't leave till they took Marsh's body out also. The plane burned to a crisp. On November 17, McGovern flew his second mission as Serbeck's co-pilot. The target was the marshalling yards in Győr, Hungary. Over the target, the flak began. It was heavy and accurate. Sticking tight to the formation, his plane and the others could achieve a better bomb pattern, but it also made a concentrated target for the flak gunners. It was just solid black, except for flashes of red where shells were exploding, McGovern remembered. The Germans were using a box-type defense. Each of the 88s fired into an area as the bombers approached, the shells traveling faster than the speed of sound and set to explode at the group's altitude. They just boxed it. The boxes were 2,000 feet deep and 2,000 feet wide, sometimes more. The German anti-aircraft units employed almost 1 million personnel and operated over 50,000 guns, most of them the dreaded 88s. The shells were time-fused to explode at 20,000 feet or above or below that altitude, according to the flight pattern. as the shells exploded, sending out hundreds of pieces of steel shrapnel that had a killing zone radius of some 30 feet, the bombers flew into them. "Well, they had filled that box," McGovern said. A standard expression from Serbeck or crew members was that the flak was so thick you could walk on it. McGovern often wondered if that's the way hell looks. Another pilot, Lieutenant Robert Reichard, recalled that the barrage was so intense that the daylight disappeared and it was as if someone had cut out the sun. The B-24s had nowhere to hide, and with the ground 25,000 feet below, there was no place to dig in. The bursts around them posed a threat to the airplane, as it had 10 500-pound bombs and over 2,000 gallons of 100-octane gas on board. When the bombs dropped, the plane jumped a few feet. "Everything improved when they went away," Lieutenant Vincent Fagan remembered. "The plane was 5,000 or 6,000 pounds lighter. We were leaving the flak instead of going into it, and we could take evasive action, usually a diving turn towards the shortest escape route from the flak area." One didn't always get out of the flak. On his first mission, October 7, 1944, B-24 pilot J.I. Merritt in Liberty Bell flew over Vienna to hit an oil refinery. After dropping the bombs, he banked steeply to the left and headed toward the rally point and home. Sergeant Art Johnson, a waste gunner and assistant engineer, was on his 26th mission. He recalled, "We had flown through the worst of the flak. I sighed a bit, for this was my third time in the vicinity of Vienna, and I knew about where the flak began and ended." Just then, there were four explosions in quick succession. Johnson's oxygen hose pulled apart. His gun was knocked out of his hand, and he hit the floor hard. Luckily, his headset stayed connected, and he heard Merritt ask, "Is everyone okay?" Johnson checked the tail gunner and the ball turret gunner, then pressed his mic. "Pilot from left waist, everyone okay back here?" But he added, "Number 3 engine throwing oil and smoke. Number 4 dead. Holes in flaps and wings. Over." Johnson later found out that the first burst had exploded directly in front of the plane, and the force of it took the top off the nose turret. The second burst came through and cut the nose wheel and tire in two, cut the interphone lines to the nose and also the oxygen lines. The third burst ripped up the underside of the right wing and exploded in number 4 engine. The gunner in the top turret, Sergeant Nick Corbo, had just breathed easy and said to himself, "We've made this one," when the bursts came. One piece of shrapnel exploded through the flight deck. Johnson and the other crew members began throwing everything that was loose out of the plane, ammunition, guns, flak suits, anything and everything that was loose except themselves. Merritt fought the wheel as the plane heaved and slowed to the brink of stalling. Then it began dropping. Gasoline streamed from the riddled wing tanks, filling the plane with the reek of the fuel. Only one engine was still working, and that one hardly was. The plane had dropped from 25,000 feet to 12,000 and was still going down. Merritt managed to get up some speed and cross into Yugoslavia. Down to 2,000 feet and almost out of fuel, he called out over the intercom, "Bail out and good luck." Johnson recalled that the right waist gunner was the first out, followed by the tail gunner and the ball turret gunner. "I was alone in back. I faced the front of the ship and put my head between my knees, and out I went. The slipstream caught me, and I went end for end. By the time I had slowed down a bit, I had pulled my ripcord. One long pull. I was jerked straight up and down as the silk billowed open, and I breathed a prayer of thanks." Johnson and the others, including Merritt and the co-pilot, landed more or less intact. They were picked up by partisans, who managed to get them back to Italy, but not until November 26. Lieutenant Glenn Rendall, a co-pilot from Hollywood, California, with the 514th Squadron, said that on his first mission, the flak exceeded whatever we expected. On McGovern's second mission, one bomber of the group was lost. Again, there were clouds, but the lead bomber had the Mickey radar and used it to find the railroad and dropped his bombs. The 27 planes following did also, but because of the clouds, no observation of results could be made. On his first mission, Navigator Pepin of the 741st saw a lot of flak, saw some B-24s get hit, but his plane managed to drop its bombs successfully. He felt a sense of joy as the plane headed home. The bomb bay doors were closing, and the aircraft's speed was increasing. The going-home sight of the Alps in the early afternoon was far more beautiful than the morning one. The radio men tuned to the armed services radio station in Foggia, and over the intercom, the crew listened to the latest hit records. Both danger and the crew's stamina diminished on the homebound run, and our elation and silliness increased. Everyone was tired, hungry, and thirsty, as their breakfast and coffee had been hours ago. Finally, Pepin could see Cerignola, and his plane circled the field. Then, and on later missions, my favorite sight and sound was hearing the tires touch the steel mat on landing and seeing the props come to a halt. After 9 hours of grueling, horrendous, nerve-wracking flying, the mission was over. For Sergeant Robert Hammer, now a radio operator with the 742nd Squadron, his first mission was in late September. Target, the airfield outside Munich. Two of the men in his crew, a bombardier and a flight engineer, were on their last missions before going home. A fighter escort joined them, and we were bouncing gaily along in the blue when dead ahead a thick, coal-black cloud appeared. "Take a good look at it, fellas," the veteran bombardier called over the intercom, "because it's flak, and you'll be seeing plenty of it from now on." Hammer was appalled to see the squadron of B-24s ahead fly directly into the stuff. "Fools," he thought. "Why don't they just fly around it?" He saw two planes get hit and start down. Shortly after, we were heading for that same suicidal cloud. The plane started bucking like a rodeo bronco. There was a crack. Hammer looked quizzically at the veteran engineer who pointed to a hole an inch long and a quarter inch wide made by shrapnel. After what seemed an eternity that in fact had lasted for less than 10 minutes, the bombs were away and Hammer's plane turned for home. We were combat veterans now. Radio operator Sergeant Howard Goodner flew his first mission in October 1944. His plane was a B-24 flown by Lieutenant Richard Farrington. His squadron was the 787th, a part of the 466th Bomb Group, 8th Air Force. Low clouds covered the airfield, and when Farrington got his craft off the ground, he could not see. Flying blind as he climbed, relying on his instruments, following his heading, Farrington was quickly covered with sweat. Up, up, up he went, until he got above the clouds. No amount of practice could have prepared the pilot and crew for what they encountered. B-24s, glittering like mica, were popping up out of the clouds over here, over there, everywhere. They formed up and straightened out for the target. Farrington called out over the intercom, "This is it, boys. We're on our way to the war." Ahead, shells were bursting all over the sky, sending out shards of shrapnel. The lead squadron of B-24s penetrated the flak. "Mary, Mother of God," one crew member mumbled into the intercom. "Mary, Mother of God, get me out of this." Farrington took them right into it. Jarring detonations erupted around them. The plane bumped and shuddered, but it kept flying straight and level until the bombs were released. Farrington banked, got away from the flak, and headed home. Sergeant Goodner reached into his jacket pocket for the Tootsie Roll he carried with him. It was frozen solid. When the plane landed, Goodner had his first mission behind him. On November 18, McGovern was Serbeck's co-pilot on another milk run. The target was the German airfield near Vicenza, Italy. The weather was fair, and the bombing was visual. Over 50% of the bombs fell in the target area, causing extensive damage to the installation. Flak was light and generally inaccurate. No German fighters were seen. The group returned to Cerignola without casualties. McGovern flew again the next day, and it was no milk run. The target was a refinery near Vienna. Because of cloud cover, the lead plane used its Mickey, and no results were seen. but dropping bombs by radar instead of visually meant few of them hit what they wanted them to hit, and the damage was minimal. Flak was intense, but inaccurate, and all planes returned to base. On November 20, on McGovern's final mission as a co-pilot, the target was factories at Zlín, Czechoslovakia. It was a secondary or alternative target, but the original objective had been obscured by clouds, so the lead pilot took the group to Zlín. There, the weather was clear, and the bombing was done visually with excellent results. Best of all, there was no flak over Zlín. All planes returned safely. After debriefing, McGovern would meet with Rounds, Adams, and his crew. They fired questions at him about what it was like, most of all, the flak. They were filled with questions every day, McGovern recalled, waiting for me when I came back. Once the session was over, McGovern would steer his way into the officers' club for a Coca-Cola or a beer. There he would listen to the veteran pilots talk and ask his own questions. It was shop talk. From almost every one of the discussions, he would absorb information. The topics were the B-24s, the crews, the Germans. What RPM at what altitude? Why was this gauge or that instrument malfunctioning? Is there any way to stay straight and level over the target and still avoid the flak? How long can an engine be on fire before it detonates the gas tank? What can you do when a bomb gets stuck in the bomb bay? How does the plane fly with only three engines operating? With two? When the hydraulic system has leaked or been shot out, how do you get the wheels down? McGovern had flown four missions in 4 days. These consecutive missions were about the absolute limit. They left the pilot and his crew haggard, worn, jumpy, frazzled, and spent. But each one counted toward the 35 missions that, when completed, would allow McGovern to return to the States. When he had time to write to Eleanor, McGovern noted the number in his letter, number 5, after the mission to Zlín. I worried, as any wife would, Eleanor said 3 decades later. I would feel a stab of fear whenever someone knocked at the door or the telephone rang. The first thing I would do when I got a letter from George was to scan through it for a number, the number of missions completed. That was the first thing I wanted to know. Then I'd go back and read the letter. On December 16, radio operator Sergeant Mel Ten Hagen flew his first mission against a refinery at Brooks, Czechoslovakia. Because the crew were new, the pilot, Lieutenant Cord, was a veteran of 31 missions. Ten Hagen's regular pilot flew as co-pilot that day. There was another newcomer, a photographer, on his 17th mission. Theirs would be one of the last two planes on the bomb run, and his photos would be among the official records of the raid's effect. When the group formed up and headed for the target, Ten Hagen saw a seemingly endless line of planes. I'd never seen this many in one place at one time. He thought that, obviously, Rosie the Riveter back home had been very busy. The bombers were at 25,000 feet, just below the 26,000-foot ceiling for the craft. On his B-24, Ten Hagen was in charge of the chaff, what he had called Christmas tree tinsel back home. Its purpose was to confuse German radar, which otherwise would lock onto the group and know what altitude to set the fuses for the shells to explode. The chaff was in packets, each one wrapped and tied with a plain brown band, each one crimped to open in the wind and allow the foil to drift down in individual pieces. Most veterans thought the chaff didn't do much, if any good, but they tossed it out of the plane with great gusto anyway. When his plane got to the initial point and turned, then straightened for the bomb run, Ten Hagen saw numerous little puffs ahead, forming a black cloud shaped like an elongated shoebox. The leader of his squadron was flying through it. Those behind were about to enter the German box. It was time to pull the flak jackets on. These were for the crew, whose members did not have the cast-iron protection the pilot and co-pilot did. The jackets consisted of irregularly shaped metal plates stitched between two sheets of canvas to form a vest. To Ten Hagen, their purpose seemed primitive, identical to that of suits of armor. They weighed about 20 pounds each. Most veterans decided early on not to wear them, but to put them between their seats and their butts, thus protecting the most important part. Over the target, with flak bursting from shells all around his plane, Ten Hagen started dropping the chaff packets through one of the waste windows. After dropping one, he tried to count to 10 as he had been told before letting the next one go, but in the midst of the flak, he seldom got past 2 or 3. Then, the plane to his right got hit. A flak explosion at its number 3 engine had blown the right wing from the body. The scene was incomprehensible. The wing tumbled over and down, and the fuselage was nosing into a dive. There were no parachutes. The bam, bam, bams and poof, poof, poofs were exploding everywhere. It was inconceivable to fly through this unscathed. The bomber lurched. "Have we been hit?" Ten Hagen wondered. Through the intercom, he heard the bombardier say, "Bombs away!" The most beautiful words in the English language, according to one pilot. Then the bombardier continued, "Now let's get the hell out of here." After a pause, he came on the intercom again to say, "I wasn't supposed to add that last part." Lieutenant Cord banked the plane into a steep dive to the right. Ten Hagen thought, "Thank you, God." Cord came on the intercom to ask each crew member to report any damage. None. When they were out of the flak, Ten Hagen lifted his oxygen mask and shouted above the engine noise to the photographer. "You've been through 17 of these now. Was this flak typical, lighter, worse, or what?" The photographer grinned and shouted back, "It wasn't light. Each mission seems to get worse, but I can't believe they could get more up here than they did." Over the intercom, Cord asked, "Flight engineer back there?" He wanted to know what the trouble was with the gas gauges. Number 3 engine sputtered and quit. "Get something to 3, Cord ordered. "I'm trying," the engineer answered. "I'm trying." Cord realized what had happened. On the intercom, he said, "The bastards hit our gas lines over the target. They've just vibrated loose." The number 2 engine quit. The engineer repeated that he was trying to transfer the gasoline flow. He could not. "We're losing altitude and control," Cord yelled. "We're at 16,000. A couple of seconds back, we were at 18. He added, "Stand by to bail if necessary." Then number 4 engine quit. Then number 1. There was a long moment of quiet, only the sound of the wind that buffeted the plane about in the glide. Then the terrible clanging of the bailout bell crashed the quiet. Everyone got out okay, landed safely, and became POWs. For Ten Hagen, the co-pilot, and the rest of the crew, it was their first mission. It was number 32 for Lieutenant Cord. For the photographer, number 17. For all of them, it was the last. Anonymous made up words to sing to the tune of "As Time Goes By." You must remember this. The flak can't always miss. Somebody's gotta die. The odds are always too damned high. As flak goes by. It's still the same old story. The 8th gets all the glory, while we're the ones who die. The odds are always too damned high as flak goes by. Once in the fall of 1944, McGovern went up in a practice run with only his co-pilot, Bill Rounds, and his navigator, Sam Adams, along. McGovern was upset with Rounds, because while McGovern was flying co-pilot with Serbeck, Rounds used his free time to go into Chirignola to find a girl. He contracted VD and had to be treated with sulfa powder. McGovern was about ready to kick him off the plane, but on this practice mission, which was done primarily to give the co-pilots who had not yet been flying some experience, Rounds did most of the flying. "He took that plane as if he'd been doing this all his life," McGovern said. "I think I could have done as well, but I couldn't have done any better, and I had a lot of practice." Rounds just tucked into position and held it there. That night, the pilot of the lead plane, a captain, came to McGovern in the officers' club to say, "You know, George, you've got one hell of a valuable co-pilot. He flies the best formation of any co-pilot I've seen. That guy's tremendous. You better hold on to him with both hands." Right then, McGovern decided to forget about Rounds' VD. He figured he had better let the man do what he wanted on his off hours. Lieutenant Donald Currier was a part of one of the first B-24 squadrons of the 15th Air Force to arrive in Italy, and thus flew his first mission in January 1944, one of the first of his group. It was 2 days after his squadron had arrived in Italy. The target was the railroad yards in Perugia, just off the Tiber River, in support of the ground troops. But when the bombers arrived, it was snowing. Landmarks were obscured. The lead navigator, having no radar, which only came 9 months later, was unable to see anything but clouds. Currier was the navigator flying in the B-24 on the wing of the lead plane. "I looked desperately for something I could see and recognize," he recalled, but he saw nothing. The lead plane opened its bomb bays. The bombardier in Currier's plane followed the leader. He put his finger on the toggle switch. When the leader dropped his bombs, he and the other bombardiers did the same. Currier saw the bombs fall in open countryside. He saw some bursts of flak on one side and far away and thought, "I don't know why the Germans bothered. We certainly didn't do them any harm." He and the pilot and crew resolved we would go again and again until we got it right. Currier would go on to make a career in the Air Force. Looking back 4 decades, he said that in his experience, "It seems incredible that we would be flying a combat mission with so little training or experience." But that was how badly the 15th needed pilots and crews in January 1944. It was because of that need that the AAF instituted the policy of requiring just-arrived pilots to fly as co-pilots for 5 missions before taking up their own plane and crew, since the men had gone through the speeded-up training program in 1944. In 1945, the commanders changed policy again, putting new pilots and their crews into action as soon as they arrived in Italy. And it was the casualty list that forced the commanders of the bomb groups to keep demanding more replacements. Bombardier Lieutenant Donald Kay arrived in Italy in May 1944 and was assigned to the 783rd Squadron, 465th Bomb Group. Of the 3 classmates in Bombardier School who came over with Kay and were close friends, 2 were killed in the air and the other became a POW. Overall, Kay recalled that of the 17 original crews that started the war with him, only 6 finished. Sergeant Anthony Picardi of the 455th Bomb Group's 742nd Squadron, who had visited his family's village and met his grandmother, saw a B-24 crash on the runway while trying to take off for a mission. It blew up on impact. 9 of the 10 crew members were blown to bits, but 1 had his arms blown off from the elbow down and his legs blown off from the knees down. He was actually crawling away from the inferno. He was digging into the dirt with the stubs of his elbows trying to survive. Right then and there, I realized just how precious life is. He crawled right up to us, looked us straight in the eyes, and then closed his eyes forever. For McGovern, on his first 5 missions as Serbeck's co-pilot, things were not so rough. He saw some flak, went through it, and got out of it safely. The B-24 did not take 1 hit. "I felt rather secure after flying those missions," McGovern said. He summed up what he had learned from observing Serbeck. "I heard through the earphones how he handled the radio transmissions to the tower and to the lead plane. I saw how he brought the plane into formation, how slowly or swiftly he got that done. I watched him to see what he was looking at and listened to the way he was handling the crew. Everything he said I could hear through my earphones. I saw how he flew formation in various positions, on the left side one day, and the next he might be in the middle, the next day on the right wing. I could observe all those things without having the responsibility of handling the plane myself. I picked up a lot of touches." This was not practice flying in Idaho. This was Europe, and the formation was much bigger, sometimes 500 or 600 planes. After completing his 5 missions as Serbeck's co-pilot, McGovern said, "I felt comfortable to take that plane up with my own crew and get it into formation and get off on a combat mission."